Thank you very much. So I'd like to tell you a bit about the why and the how of this book, this rather ambitious book, some people think rather hubristic book, which leads me on to the second topic I'd like to talk about, which is some of the response that the book has received. It's received a very interesting response in the Chinese sense of interesting. You know, the Chinese say, may you not live in interesting times. So it has been quite an interesting ride. Some time ago now, about 30 years ago, when I was doing research at Oxford, and I was looking at the normative ethical systems around the world. That means those ethical systems which address themselves to guidance or suggestion or direction on the great question of how we should live our lives and what values we should live by. And I noticed a very marked contrast between those that premise themselves on a religious tradition or religious outlook, and on the other hand, what I very broadly describe as a humanist outlook, which is one that starts from our best understandings, very often our most sympathetic and generous understanding of human nature and the human condition. And in fact, that second group of traditions, looking at this great question of how we should live, happens to be perhaps the set of defining traditions of our great civilizations. So, for example, in classical antiquity, in ancient Greece, in the Hellenic world and the Roman world, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, the post-Aristotelian schools, the Epicureans and the Stoics, or all of them, humanist in their outlook. They didn't regard our ethical imperatives as having been offered by a deity. They didn't claim that they were conveying a message from beyond. Their premise was their own experience of life and their observation of what it is to be human. And the same is true of the great Chinese tradition through Confucius and Mencius, Mozi, Juxi, and the great thinkers of ancient China, right up through the legalist and neo-Confucian schools. And indeed, there is a strand of development of thinking that runs from these antiquities of our great civilizations through to the modern era. You might see a sort of repetition of enlightenments in the Renaissance, in the 18th century enlightenment itself, where there is a return to the sources and resources of those thoughts, which are very marked in their contrast, in the premises on which they rest themselves from the religious traditions. Now, the religious traditions in the world today, in the three great religions, really, of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. In the Indian subcontinent, the word Hinduism collects a number of religious traditions. That word was coined by colonists, really, trying to make sense of the great variety of thinking about the spiritual and the transcendent in India. But these traditions, all of them, have at their root the idea of a relationship between God and mankind, between the creator and creation. And it is a feature of this relationship, especially in the Judeo-Christian and Islamic traditions, that it is one of dependency of mankind on God, and that what God does is to impose a set of requirements, of obligations in that relationship, a requirement for that dependency to be realized by the creation, and a response made to those demands. So the very word Islam means submission. In the Christian tradition, one of the great sins is the sin of pride, the sin of thinking that you can stand on your own two feet and make decisions for yourself. The very first sin recorded in the Bible, the religious Bible, the book of Genesis, is the sin of disobedience, and indeed sin means disobedience. And so that represents a very different view about the nature of the moral life, that the moral life is a response to a demand. It is in obedience to a requirement, and in its way, quite a stringent requirement, quite a demanding view of how we should live, which involves having to deny some aspects, anyway, of the animal part of our nature. Our appetites have to be governed and constrained and directed in ways which are thought to be appropriate for the life that will, if well lived, issue finally in acceptance into a felicific dispensation, heaven, or the rapture. And this world is a preparation for that world. So it's a very different focus. The humanist tradition focuses on this life in the here and now. And it asks the question, how should one live in the here and now? And it attempts to give answers to that question, attempts to give some insight into the variety of human experience and some suggestion about how people might try best to live it. And when I noticed this contrast, I thought to myself, well, we know a great deal about how the religious Bible was made. Biblical scholarship of the last couple of centuries has been very, very revealing indeed about the process by which the Old Testament and New Testament evolved. And did so by the work of many hands, taking many documents and putting them together by an editorial process known as redaction, which is a process where source texts are taken, their bits are selected from them, they're woven together, other texts might be interpolated in them, there'll be modification and arrangement of the texts. Very occasionally, I imagine, inconvenient occurrences of the word not were deleted, and you get, or indeed inserted occasionally if things are going in the wrong direction. And the result is a text which has a certain tendency, tells a certain story, paints a certain picture. So I thought, well, supposing somebody or some group of people did the same thing to the texts of the non-religious traditions, went to them and chose from them documents which address this very, very important central question of how we should choose our values and how we should pursue them, how we should form really good relationships with other people, how we should exercise our responsibilities to others and to ourselves. Supposing people had gone to Aristotle, to Cicero, to Seneca, Pliny, Plutarch, Epictetus, had gone to Muozzo and Zhuxi, had gone to the great non-religious traditions of India. There are several very ancient, deep atheist traditions of thought in the Indian tradition. Had gone to the writers of the Enlightenment, so the Renaissance and the 18th century Enlightenment and beyond, had really gone to the literature of the world, which focused on the inspirations, the insights, the consolations that came out of human experience, took those documents and did the same thing to them as had produced the Bible, exactly the same process. And of course, immediately I had that thought, the next thought occurred, which was, why not have a go? So I thought I might try. This was about 30 years ago. I started to do that, to gather text. Every time I came across something I thought would be very useful, I made a note of it and pulled it together. And over time began to do that work of redaction, of arrangement and modification, contributing sort of introductory passages and linking passages here and there and one or two others. But, you know, 99%, 98% of this book is drawn from these extraordinary, rich resources. There's a treasure house of insight and inspiration in these great, great traditions of thought by these great minds. And these people, by the way, who wrote these books, their life and their experience of life is very different from ours. It was much more like what it must be to live in Benghazi or Kabul or Baghdad today. You know, a much more precarious kind of life, a shorter life, a life pressed and pressured by experiences that we don't ordinarily, if we're lucky, have in our safe and developed Western world today. And so their commentary on the human condition and what they say, what they suggest in the way of advice to us about how we might respond to things and think about things is deeply valuable because it was squeezed out of them by reality. Now, if there is one overarching theme in the book, it is that in the end, we have to think for ourselves. We have to be responsible for our own choices. We have to own the decisions that we make about how we're to live. We have to see clearly what it is that we are capable of and how best we can relate to other people, because good relationships lie at the very heart of good lives. And in the end, it's our decision and our choice. And that's very, very important. And it's a very important fact about the book itself, because whereas other books of this kind tell people what to do, what to think, what to believe, how to behave, this book doesn't. That is the only injunction. Think for yourself. And all the rest is materials, resources, suggestions and insights that people might take and use in the process of their own thinking about these things. And thinking about these things is of the most vital importance, there's no question. And the question, of course, is Socrates' question. Now, Socrates lived at a time when there was a great switch from one way of thinking about the right organization of society and how we should comport ourselves to others, really a time governed by what were known as the warrior virtues. It's very interesting that the word virtue has as its first syllable the Latin word for man, vir, or vir, as some people rather weirdly call it, but vir, meaning man. And the warrior virtues were the virtues of courage in battle, fortitude, ferocity, preparedness to defend the tribe or the city. Those were what virtues were. But at Socrates' time, the time of Pericles and Athens and afterwards, when society developed, mature society in the Greek context, we're beginning to think a little bit about civic virtues, about how we live together, how we cooperate, how we share things, how we learn from one another. The civic virtues are very different from the warrior virtues because they're about peace and construction as against war and destruction. And Socrates went around asking people, how should we live? How do you think we should live our lives? What values should we be seeking to realize in our lives? And that's a very, very, very important question. Socrates also said, the unconsidered life, the one that hasn't been thought about and chosen, is not really worth living because it's somebody else's life. If we don't think about our values and how we're going to realize them, then we're living somebody else's choices. We're like a football that they're kicking. But if we own our own choices and we have this idea that we're moving in a certain important direction, then we are in to that extent anyway, we are not perhaps in control, but certainly we are trying to take responsibility for it, and that counts. Now, a very interesting implication of this challenge posed by Socrates to everybody is that each individual is capable of doing that thinking, and each individual is capable of making certain choices that, when acted upon, will make a life that is good and worthwhile. And he didn't claim to know the answer, and he certainly didn't claim to be in a position to impose on everybody a sort of one-size-fits-all answer to the question of how we should live. And yet, that is what the great absolutisms of history have done. It's not just the religions which have done this. It was Stalin in the Soviet Union, for example. Any totalizing monolithic ideology, any mindset, any outlook on life which says there is one great truth, one right way, one correct answer, and everybody has to believe it or agree to it or toe the line. That view that we're all dragooned or should be dragooned into an orderly queue of belief and obedience. And of course, throughout history, it's mainly been the religions that have done this, but as I say, it's the structure rather than the belief system which is the important thing here. That is what history has imposed on humanity for most of its course. And the implication of Socrates' challenge to people was that that's not true. It isn't the case that there's one correct answer or one great truth. Instead, there is the answer and the truth that we each of us make or find or have a talent for in our own lives. Now, I don't mean by this a kind of relativism. I don't mean that what's true for me is false for you, or what's right for me is wrong for you. I don't mean it in that sense at all. What I mean is that the diversity and plurality of human nature and human experience is such that each one of us should be able and is able to find a way of living which is genuinely rich and satisfying and worthwhile, and in which the relationships are therefore good and flourishing relationships, commensurate with our own individual talents for doing that, our own capacities, and the result of our own attempt to educate ourselves to do that well. That's a very, very important point. It doesn't mean relativism. It doesn't mean that there aren't very many commonalities, shared things between human beings, which make us all members of one family. This is why we're able to say that we all need privacy. We all need certain rights, freedom of expression, and the ability to choose where we live and what kind of work we do and who we are going to associate with. These are very important and fundamental rights that we all share. So there is a great deal of commonality, but at the same time, there's also a great deal of individuality, and that individuality has to be expressed, because if we're not allowed to be individuals, then our natures are distorted and our possibilities are limited. And the quickest way to explain this is to remind you of what George Bernard Shaw said about the Golden Rule. And the Golden Rule is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. George Bernard Shaw said, under no circumstances should you do to other people what you'd like them to do to you, because they may not like it. And it's a very, very profound insight. You have to remember that people's tastes differ, people's interests differ. And if you make yourself the benchmark, the standard of how everybody else should be treated, you know, everybody's going to be treated the way you like to be treated, then that's a very distorting view. You have to recognize and accept and honor those differences, of course, up to the limit of the harm principle, as John Stuart Mill called it. John Stuart Mill said there should be a great variety of experiments in human living, and people should be given the freedom to develop themselves and their lives in ways that seem good and suitable to them, always remembering that each one of us has the responsibility not to harm others, not to limit other people in their endeavor to do that. That is a bottom line that every one of us must observe. And that means that we must be tolerant. We've got to respect the differences between us and others. And tolerance is very difficult. We all think we're tolerant. It's really because we don't mind. When we do mind, we find it jolly hard to accept what other people do and think. I remember, and some of you will remember, Mrs. Mary Whitehouse. Do you remember her? The only woman in the world who had a television set without an off button. So she had to watch everything, all the nudity and so on that she disapproved of. And because her television didn't have an off button, she wanted the television companies not to put these programs out. I don't like it, therefore you're not allowed to watch it. That was her attitude, the attitude of the moralist and the Puritan, who wants to impose her decisions and tastes on everybody else. And that is utterly wrong, as you can see. That if you respect plurality, diversity, difference between people, you respect their right to the endeavor to create something good for themselves and those they care about. Again, under that command of the harm principle. They're not allowed to harm other people. We've got to be open-minded and open-hearted, not so open-minded that our brains fall out, obviously. We need standards, and we need to talk to one another and negotiate and have a conversation about what we can agree on and accept. But that agreement should be a very generous one, because we should recognize that people are different. And that, you remember the Monty Python thing where Brian shouts out to the crowd, "You're all different," and they all shout back, "We're all different," except for the one person who says, "I'm not," and then it's it.
You're listening to philosopher A.C. Grayling, author of The Good Book, one of the most popular sessions of the whole Sydney Writers' Festival, right here on ABC Radio National.
In fact, in a way, the gift to us of the 18th century Enlightenment was the final clear clarion call assertion of this fact about our individuality, about the need for rights and civil liberties which would respect that, and at last free people to do this work, the work that Socrates demanded we do, which is to think about the good life. So what I did was I went to these resources, I gathered together these texts, I worked on them and redacted them and put them together in such a way as to provide materials, the materials of insight and suggestion and inspiration and consolation that might help people who are doing this work of thinking for themselves about how ultimately they're going to live and what choices ultimately they're going to make. There's nothing in there of the nature of a commandment other than think for yourself. There's nothing in there which says, do this, do that, believe this, believe that, and if you do, you'll get a reward, and if you don't, you're in big trouble. None of that. It just respects the autonomy of the individual, indeed makes a demand on that autonomy, which is to exercise it. Because, of course, one of the hardest things in the world is to do this. Most people would rather not have to think. They want other people to do the thinking for them already. They'd like to pop along to the frozen warehouse of ideas and just take out a sort of a pizza which says, this is how you live, this is what you believe, this is right, and consume it, defrost it to some extent and consume it. And because it is quite hard, again, one of my favorite jokes is what Bertrand Russell said, most people would rather die than think, and most people do. And so this is a serious problem for the world. Because if people are unreflective and they just accept teachings and accept ancient traditions, without realizing it, viewing the world through the lens of ideas that were first developed by illiterate goatherds who lived 3,000 years ago, then unless they're challenged to think that through and think it afresh, they're not going to become to something which belongs to them, which is autonomous to them. And it is quite hard work doing that thinking. It really is. I very often have conversations with cab drivers in London. You know what they're like. They're all professional philosophers and pessimists. And they ask me what I do. I don't say I'm a philosopher, by the way. Aristotle and Socrates and people like that were philosophers. So it's a tall order to claim that you are one. But I say I teach philosophy and write about it. And they and assume that I am one, with a capital F. So they ask me the question, What's the meaning of life then? Yeah, sorry. All right, Governor, what's the meaning of life then, they say. And I say, I know the answer to that question, much to their surprise. I do, I know the answer to that question. The answer is, the meaning of life is what we make it. Each one of us can make our lives meaningful by our choices, our goals, the aims that we set ourselves and how we live them, how we think about them. There's not one meaning which everybody could discover or be told about or commanded to believe. There are lots and lots of meanings, lots of good meanings, and each one of us can make that meaning in our own lives from our own talents for it. But when I say that to my cab driver, then the next thing the cab driver thinks, I can sort of hear the thought going on, is what does a philosopher do when he gets up in the morning? You know what a plumber or a carpenter does, or a cab driver for that matter, but what does a philosopher do? Does he get himself into the position and have thoughts? Oddly enough, the answer is yes. I don't know about the position exactly, but the thinking anyway. And I like to remind my students, I tell them, I say to them, got to remember the story of the two old ladies on the Glasgow bus overheard talking, one saying to the other, "My dear, you must be philosophical about this. Don't give it another thought." Because of course there's a... And they never forget that story. So you do get up in the morning and try to think. But what is it to think? I mean, very often people say, come away from a lecture or they read a book of philosophy, think, I'm going to think. I'm going to really think about my values now. I'm going to do it on Thursday afternoon, 4 o'clock. And they get themselves into the position and they're going to think about their values. And then after a few long blank seconds, "I forgot to get such at the supermarket," pops into the mind. It's not sort of obvious and easy in a way to get involved in this process. But here's how you do it. You do it by talking to others, listening to other people's opinions, by reading. That's the great resource. And even more to the point, reflecting on reading. A good reader is a thoughtful, responsive reader, a reader who thinks and discusses what is read. It was somebody who said, I think it might have been La Rochefoucauld, who said, you can't expect if an ass looks into a mirror that an angel will look back. Well, it's the same as the reader of a text. If an ass looks into the text, you can't expect an angel to speak to him back, because you're party to that process. So reading, discussing, asking people their opinions and testing and evaluating those opinions, forming them of your own, trying them out, being prepared to change your mind when better arguments and better evidence come forward. It's a process, it's a dynamic. The quest to find the good, to find your own particular line, your own talent or capacity to make something really meaningful out of your life and in your life and in your relationships, that is itself, the quest itself, the journey towards that ideal, is itself the good and well-lived life. And we all know, because there are lots of clichés to that effect, that it is the journey, not the arrival, that matters. And it couldn't be more true than in this connection, the connection of how trying to discern how we should live and what our values should be. The endless, tireless, energetic, vigorous, self-demanding quest to seek things that are good and to make things that are good in our lives, that is the good life. And by the way, it's not the goody two-shoes life. It's not conventional morality. It's not, being all sort of prissy about adultery and things like that. That's not to the point in a way. Oddly, it's very, very odd that a lot of conventional morality concerns itself with things that, although they have their significance, of course, and they can involve things which are harmful and hurtful to people and trying not to hurt others, trying to be a constructive, a good neighbor to others and understanding the frailties and difficulties that others have as we ourselves do. That generous attitude to others, that preparedness, as Emerson said, to give them what we give a painting, namely the advantage of a good light. That work, that endeavor is really important and central to this development of a good life, but it is not a moralizing one. It's not refusing to accept other people's choices and condemning them for it unless their choices are very harmful to others. It's not about worrying about nudity on television when just down the road there's an arms factory exporting Kalashnikovs to fuel terrible conflicts in the Horn of Africa. One's got to get one's values right and one's proportions correct in order to see what really does matter and what really does do harm in this world. and to see instead how some of the things that people have traditionally looked down upon are actually part of the great pleasure of life. Remember Oberon Waugh, son of Evelyn Waugh, editor of the Literary Review in London, said of all the courtesans in the world, said, just think how much joy they've added to human history. And that gives you a different perspective on things somewhat, although, of course, there are other aspects to that that might be somewhat less positive. But it's a thought, anyway, that gives a little adjustment to the tiller, a little corrective to our normal instincts about what counts as right and wrong. We shouldn't be conventional and moralistic. We should be generous and sort of capacious in our understanding of human variety. So the Good Book is an attempt to draw together resources that might be of some help to people who are thinking this through, going through the process that is a process of thinking and making decisions about these matters. Now, when I was putting the book together, I made some decisions, important decisions, about how to do it, about how I should present all this material. And I decided to model it on the King James Version of the Bible, published 400 years ago this year. It's an entire coincidence, by the way, that my 30-year journey to produce this book happened to land in the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible. Serendipitous and rather a lucky coincidence in a way, because it meant, among other things, that I was able to have a very collegial and warm discussion with Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, in London last week about the Good Book and about its relation to the King James Bible. Now, the King James Bible, published in 1611, is laid out in a way that we've become familiar with and we think is the standard biblical format, and that is double column, chapter and verse. And one reason for the success of the King James Bible, apart from the great beauty of the language, because it is a very, very beautiful document, it was produced at a time in the 16th and early 17th century when the English language was at one of its poetic heights. So it is a very beautiful document. But also the way it's physically laid out makes it a very inviting, a very attractive and accessible read. You can read just one or two verses. The chapters are short, so you could read a chapter. If you wanted to, you could read the long, long, long tracts of Chronicles and Kings and Samuel, the great history books of the Old Testament, for example. A very unedifying read in some respects, you may remember. There's some examples set there. Think of King David seeing Bathsheba in her bath on her rooftop, fancying her, sending her husband off to the war with instructions that he be put in the front line, inviting Bathsheba to come round and making her his mistress. Well, they're full of edifying tales in the Old Testament. So, very, very, very accessible and attractive layout, so I chose the layout. I also respected a decision that the King James makers made about the language that they used, this beautiful language of their version of the Bible. They decided that their language should be old-fashioned. In fact, the language of the King James Bible was 100 years out of date when it was published in 1611, and its contemporary readers would have recognized it as such, because it's mainly the language of Tyndale, the translator a century beforehand of the Bible into English. The King James makers used Tyndale's translation. They claim in their letter, dedicatory epistle to King James, that they had newly translated the Bible. They hadn't. They'd taken Tyndale's version. They'd collated it with the Hebrew and Greek texts, of course, to check it. They had made some changes. But their age was an age of editorial genius, because the reason why the King James version of the Bible is so beautiful, even more beautiful than the Tyndale version, which has great virtues of its own, is that the little tweaks and touches here and there, the little editorial modifications that the King James makers adduced onto the Tyndale text, turned something good into something brilliant. Those little touches were touches of magic. Interestingly, Shakespeare did the same thing. You know, Shakespeare never made up a story or wrote a play from scratch. All Shakespeare's works are adaptations. They're from earlier texts, from other plays, other sources. He uses long tracts from Holinshed's Chronicles of the History of England. But again, by the genius of editorial modification, he turns something good and something ordinary into something transcendently wonderful. And just like their contemporaries in other art forms, Peter Paul Rubens, the great poet of female flesh, for example, Most of his paintings were painted by his workshop, by his assistants. And then he would come along and he would add a touch of colour, he would do a face, he would do the hands, so expressive in his paintings. And by those means, he would turn something good into something brilliant. It was an age of editors, if you like, of adapters. And the King James Version of the Bible was an adaptation of an adaptation. And I talked to you about how the Bible was originally made. Well, the King James makers of that version of the Bible added another layer of adaptation and produced this beautiful book. Beautiful in manner. Again, the matter is another matter. But beautiful in manner, beautiful language. So I chose to adapt their layout because of its accessibility and its readability. And I also chose to recognize the value of their decision about the language. You use a form of language which is not quite of today. The language of the Good Book is not The Wire in Baltimore or, Good Day Sydney today. Nobody has a B. But I love that fact that a beer has ceased to have a beer diphthong in Sydney. And therefore, it stands a little bit apart from today or 20 years ago or 20 years' time. And has something of that character that other translations of other holy writings have, of saying this stuff is quite significant in a way. This is quite important. These are quite important ideas which are being offered for your consideration. So let's put it in a way that has its own special character. But the more important reason, even than all that, is that the Good Book is offered very respectfully to the same space of conversation as all the other great ethical works and the other great religious works, since they all address themselves to the question of life. I think that what Aristotle had to say and Cicero and David Hume and John Stuart Mill, that what they had to say belongs in that same space of conversation, and so it's offered to it. It's a book that belongs on the same bookshelf as they, and this is something that it says about itself by the way I've laid it out and presented it. So that's how it was made, that's why it was made as it was. And I now turn to a question of the responses that I've received to it. And these responses have been extremely polarized. I've had some wonderfully warm responses, both in reviews and from people who've written and emailed and so on. Four different composers, one in Germany, one in the Netherlands, two in the United Kingdom, are setting parts of it to music. Parts of it are already being turned into a children's version with lovely illustrations. It's been translated into about 10 languages now. It's being made into an audio book. It's number one on the religion in the Amazon, both in the US and the UK. I'm a tiny bit worried about that, by the way, number one religion. I do have a slight anxiety. I should just a little footnote remark here that in 500 years' time, I'll be a god, having a... And my anxiety about it is the fact that I'll be an extremely bad one. Not that the bar has been set very high in history. But also, because I really don't want to be one. I think it would be rather difficult to be one. I remember Jim Carrey in that movie. And I have to remember that the poor old Buddha said to his disciples when he was in his last illness, he said to them, please don't make me a god and don't turn this into a religion. Buddhism, as you know, is a philosophy. It was never intended to be a religion, and it's become one because of the natural inclinations to superstition that human beings have, alas. And so in various parts of the world, even in Tibet, in Chan Buddhism in China and the various schools of Buddhism in Japan have accretions of superstition and some religious elements to them. But Buddhism in its origin is a philosophy. And yet Buddha didn't want to be a god. Nobody does, really, apart from the Roman emperors. End of footnote. Although I should just add to that footnote that my wife did send me a card which had on it a rather self-satisfied looking individual saying, I used to be an atheist until I realized I am God. So, some wonderful warm responses, really lovely emails from people. The book was published less than 2 months ago, and already I've had photographs sent to me from humanist weddings in America where some very fat people were getting married, and they used parts of the Good Book as their observance. And I'm tremendously heartened by that, and I think that's completely lovely. Somebody asked me when I was on my book tour in America whether I would mind people burning the Good Book. And I said that I'd be delighted, especially if they bought a replacement copy. But there have also been very hostile responses, as you can imagine. I mean, some of the reviews are the very worst reviews I've ever had for anything. Some of the reviews have been sort of hysterically hostile. The less encumbered the reviewer has been by actual acquaintance with the book, the more hysterical they've been in their response to it. And you can see why. I think it's rather an interesting commentary on this very bad-tempered quarrel that's been going on between religion and non-religion. I'm very proud indeed to be associated with my friends Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, with whom I agree on everything. People say that Richard can sometimes seem very rebarbative, very aggressive and confrontational, can offend people. It's mainly, of course, because Richard, for many, many, many decades, has been trying to explain evolutionary biology. And when people pop up saying that the world was created 6,000 years ago, it annoys him. And you can understand why. It's very interesting, you know, every year thousands, not hundreds, but quite literally thousands of books are published of a religious nature about prayer or about religious stories. The best-selling book in America recently has been A Little Boy Who Went to Heaven, and come back and told everybody what it's like there. And that's the best-selling book there. And thousands of such books exist. And yet half a dozen books by Dawkins and Hitchens and Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett have really got the doves in the dovecote fluttering. You know, really upset everybody and worried everybody. And I think it's an interesting fact. I think also the reaction from some people to the good book, they expecting it that it's an attack on religion or a satire on the Bible or a claim that it's going to displace the Bible. Of course, it isn't any of those things. I mean, in others of my things I've written, other books I've written, I've been very frank and blunt in my opposition to religion, yes. But this book is not an attack on religion at all. I mean, any open-minded person of religion could look into it and see what Cicero, Aristotle, or Hume, or Spinoza has to say about something and find there resources of tremendous value. These are very, very profound insights and beautiful responses to life and all its difficulties. It's a book for everybody. It's not an anti-religious book or a book only for atheists. And by the way, some of my critics have been fellow atheists. They put their hands on their hips and say, well, atheists don't need a Bible. What are you up to? They, you know, you're making it seem as though we think we're a religion. We can think for ourselves. We don't need it. It's not a necessity. And I say in response to them, you're right. You don't need it. It's not a necessity. But it might be of some use to some people. Even atheists sometimes read. And they might have to have some kind of suggestions which might help them along with their thinking, and that's fine. By the way, I also get critics who say how annoyed they are that there are no references, no footnotes. They come across some really rather wonderful insight, and they go, who said that? Who wrote that? And this is a great instinct that we all have, especially more educated you are, the more footnotes you want. And they're desperately annoyed that there aren't any footnotes. And my response to that is to say, next time you're in an art gallery, look at the people going round at that gallery. You'll notice they spend miles more time reading the little plaque next to the painting than looking at the painting. And we make this mistake with what's written. Oh, Aristotle said that. Oh, now that's pretty good. Fred Smith said it. Oh, well, who's he? Oh, if the writer, the author, the source of a saying comes between you and the saying, if you don't just focus on the idea or the insight, which is what I want, which is why I took the texts away from their sources. I don't attribute them to anybody. There they are, the ideas by themselves. And my justification for it is this, that anything wise, anything true, belongs to everybody. It doesn't matter who said it. If it's wise or true, it's our own. Anybody can take possession of it and make use of it in their lives. You can't say, oh, gosh, that's such a wonderful insight. What a pity I can't use it because Aristotle said it. Well, I mean, that would be a travesty. Also, of course, the book would have been three times as long because there would be so many footnotes, you couldn't read the text, and then there would be massive thing of references at the back. So people say to me, well, you could have put it online, couldn't you? You could have had all the footnotes and all the stuff online. That would be true too. But yet again, they would have spent all their time on the computer. Instead of thinking about the insights, they would have been looking up who said it, and that would be a distraction. So it was quite deliberate to take them away from their sources and say, here are ideas, insights, attitudes, lessons learned by our forebears in the human story, distilled and collected and brought together, offered to anybody who will read and think as a resource for thinking about life. Well, I feel, when I read the hostile reviews, the hysterical reviews, rather strangely but wonderfully impervious. Because the other thing you were reading in the bath last night was Homer's Iliad. You remember the story in there of Teucer, the archer, who hid behind the shield of the giant Ajax and would pop out every now and then to fire his arrows at the Trojans. Well, I'm like Teucer, hiding behind the shield of all these great thinkers I've brought together in this book. So when the hostile reviewers moan and groan about it, they are moaning and groaning about Aristotle and Cicero and Spinoza and Hume, little though they know it. They sort of know it, but they forget it, and in their criticism they think they're criticizing me, and I'm unscathed. Well, I offer this to you and to anybody who could make use. It's not a necessity. You don't have to have it. If you're one of those people who think that it's not necessary, I would urge this, if you think, forget this book, go to the original sources. Go and read the Nicomachean Ethics. Go and read Spinoza's great work. Go and read Hume on the Inquiry Concerning the Principles of Morals. I'd be the very, very first person to urge you to do it. Those great works of philosophy, by the way, are very accessible. I know that a lot of you have gone into the bookshop, you've taken down a book of philosophy, you've looked at it, you've turned it upside down, you've put it back on the shelf and gone and had a cup of coffee thinking to yourself, heck, you know, all those long words, marmalade and corrugated iron. I mean, they push people away, those books. That contemporary philosophy, which is very, very technical, very jargon-laden, you need to know a lot before you can get a lot out of them. There's a lot of very valuable work there, but I think philosophy belongs to everybody. And for most of its history, it was written for everybody. Aristotle didn't write for professors. There weren't any. He was writing for his educated fellows in society. So was Cicero, so was Erasmus, so was Milton, so was Hume, so was John Stuart Mill. It belongs to everybody, and their texts are accessible if you will go to them. But I imagine that as time goes by and we get more longer thumbs and shorter attention spans, so we will lose sight of this great treasure trove of wisdom that exists in all our civilized traditions. And by the way, it was a wonderful discovery as I worked on this book that an ancient Greek and an ancient Chinese philosopher felt so much the same way and said such the same things about how we should live and what we should value. That was the wonderful discovery, the great convergence of good and wise people on what the right thing for us to think is. That was a valuable lesson that I got from it. And we're in danger of losing that because, of course, in the last couple of thousand years, especially in the last 1,500 years when the monotheistic religions have been dominant in the world, they have sequestered all this insight into a little corner. It's only studied and only then in part, in philosophy departments in universities. This casket of jewels hidden away from all of us, and it belongs to all of us, and we don't get access to it. And what I've tried to bring is some of that back for people to enjoy and profit from. Thank you very much.